They're talking about quotas, and they're talking about quotas based on immutable characteristics. They're actually saying that we are not going to use as our key criteria for advancement the merit and competency of the person, but instead we're going to take their immutable characteristic. And that's a really dangerous path to go down, because it means you won't get the best people for the job.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, on this show, we talk a lot about, you know, progressivism, wokeism, diversity, inclusion, equity. These things come up a lot on our program, but today we actually have somebody who has spent a fair amount of time delving into these concepts and to maybe give us some first principles. What do we mean when we say diversity? What do we mean when we say equity? What is meant by inclusion? Who's included? Who's excluded? And his name is David Miller Haskell. Thanks for being with us on the show today, David.
It's a real pleasure. I'm grateful.
Yeah, well, we're grateful to have you. Before we introduce you more properly, as we always do, we've got some framing aphorisms that are meant to be relevant to the subject matter. The first is from somebody we quote a lot on this show. His name is Thomas Sowell, who you probably know as a brilliant economist who's at the Hoover Institute in the United States at Stanford, who wrote, "The next time some academics tell you how important diversity is, ask how many Republicans there are in their sociology department."
Right on. Yeah, exactly.
The next one is from the late Roger Scruton, who's a brilliant British author who died about 7 years ago, but left behind a wonderful legacy of books. He said, "It is not the truth of Marxism that explains the willingness of intellectuals to believe it, but the power that it confers on intellectuals in their attempts to control the world. And since it is futile to reason someone out of a thing that he was not reasoned into, we can conclude that Marxism owes its remarkable power to survive every criticism to the fact that it is not a truth-directed, but a power-directed system of thought." The next one is from Martin Luther King, the late Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. That's a principle that seems to be inverted by diversity, inclusion, equity." And finally, a funny one that comes to us from George Orwell, from his famous book, Animal Farm, which says, "All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others." So who do we have on the show today? Well, it's David Miller Haskell, PhD. He is an associate professor at Wilfrid Laurier University and a social scientist. He researches and publishes on cultural trends in Canada. And Professor Haskell is a senior fellow with the Aristotle Foundation for Public Policy. Those of you who follow the show will know that we had Dr. Mark Mielke on this program, a very fascinating episode. And so David is also part of that let's call it a think tank. So thanks for being with us today, Professor. It's great to have you on the program. I'm really looking forward to diving into this, these topics, which are of great interest to both myself and the people who follow the show.
Yeah, I am truly grateful because I've watched your show, Leighton, and I think that you have great guests and you ask great questions, and I think this is going to be a really fruitful conversation.
Yeah, I hope we can live up to the standard. I know that you certainly fit in well with the standard of guests that we've had. So let's see if I measure up to past performance. I'm going to start with a tweet from Thomas Sowell and get your take on it, and then sort of dive into your paper that you wrote recently that was also published in the Western Standard. He says, "We are among the biggest fools in history if we keep on paying people to make us hate each other, whether it's called by pretty names like multiculturalism, diversity, or gender awareness. That is what it all boils down to." What's your take on that? Do you agree with what Dr. Sowell has to say about this diversity, inclusion, equity? Is it really just designed to make us hate each other?
Well, I don't know that it was designed to make us hate each other. because some people, I think, approach it in maybe a naive spirit, or even in a positive spirit, that they actually think it might do some good. Those people are probably not very well read in the research, so we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Sowell is not wrong to say that it does make us hate each other. So I'm saying that the people involved in it might not know it. They might actually be acting in good faith. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at the evidence on the ground, it really is dividing our society more. And the basic idea that you can make society better by discrimination, I mean, and that really is the core idea of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, you quoted Martin Luther King earlier that we should be judging people by the content of their character. And I know that that's an old chestnut and it gets overused, I suppose, but it's so true. I mean, it's gold. And essentially what DEI would have us do is reverse that. And you mentioned that too. And I think that we can draw a direct line from the increase that we're seeing in anti-Semitism to the proliferation of DEI instruction in our universities and its embrace in our businesses and its embrace in our government. Because DEI really is about discrimination, and it's justifying discrimination. Mm-hmm. And insofar as you justify discrimination, you're going to get more of it. Sowell often talks about whatever you incentivize, you get more of. Whatever you stigmatize, you get less of. And we're now incentivizing discrimination.
Mm-hmm. So let's break down these concepts if we can. We recently had something called International Women's Day, and I'm the first one to applaud wonderful women and their contributions to society. I couldn't help but notice that International Women's Day happens to coincide with the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And I don't think that's accidental. And then I noticed that our Supreme Court of Canada put out a meme saying that it's very important in the context of International Women's Day to achieve diversity in the court. But I don't think they're talking about the same kind of diversity that someone like myself or you would think is beneficial. They're talking about just having more women on the court. So when people like the Supreme Court of Canada, when they're posting that meme and they're talking about diversity, or talking about diversity at the university where you live and work, what are they talking about? What do they mean when they talk about diversity?
They're talking about quotas, and they're talking about quotas based on immutable characteristics. They're actually saying that we are not going to use as our key criteria for advancement the merit and competency of the person, but instead we're going to take their immutable characteristic. And that's a really dangerous path to go down, because it means you won't get the best people for the job. Mm-hmm. Equally troubling is that it casts dispersion on anyone who might get into a position on their own merit if they hold the immutable characteristics that are now privileged. For example, when a woman becomes a judge now, are we supposed to question, are we going to question whether or not she had the competency to be in that position, or was it simply a quota to be filled? Mm-hmm. And that's terrible, because there are women who are incredibly competent, who could make it on their own merit, and now everyone will second guess whether or not they did. Similarly, anytime we have the affirmative action kind of quotas based on color, that really devalues anyone who made it on their own merit. Any person of color who is in a position of an elite position, whether it's in academia or business, are people now going to wonder, well, can you do the job, or did you get the job because of your skin? And and that is a terrible way to run a society, because eventually you will lose trust. The people who do make it on their own merit will become disheartened. And all this stems from the notions surrounding diversity, equity, and inclusion, which in and of itself, I keep talking about that. Do you mind if I just define it for a moment?
Absolutely. Great.
So there are multiple ways to see this. So I'm using diversity, equity, and inclusion and the concepts that will flow from it. But some of your audience might think of it as wokeism.
Right.
So wokeism really is another way to express the ideas of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But essentially what it does, here's kind of, if I had to make it, put it into a nutshell, it makes sacred those minorities that were historically marginalized. That's the first thing it does. Now, I'm using that word, it makes sacred, because I'm a sociologist of religion, so maybe that's the way my mind goes. But to make something sacred means that you can't criticize it. It means that you have to privilege it. You raise it while making other things, while lowering other things. So that's the first step. DEI or wokeism, it really is this idea of making sacred historically marginalized groups. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that once you've made them sacred, then you have to discriminate in order to make sure that the outcomes are better for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very important. I'm saying that you discriminate to make that happen. It's not about leveling the playing field. It's about actually cooking the books, putting your finger on the weight. You are discriminating against one group in order to give better outcomes to another.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been shown historically to not work. Mm-hmm. It will unravel your society. Now, we're able to look into the past and we say, wasn't it terrible when whites in the South of the United States would elevate themselves and would make black people inferior? We say, of course, that is horrendous. They would discriminate like that explicitly. That is
like Jim Crow or something.
Jim Crow, the redlining on housing, where they would make it so that it was difficult to get mortgages for black people, or et cetera. And we recognize the inhumanity of that. We recognize how wrong it was to discriminate. But now, under DEI or wokeism, whichever title you want to use, they're saying, let's use discrimination for a noble purpose. Well, there is no noble purpose. So in that, you see two of the key characteristics of DEI, what you really hear in these DEI training sessions. But there's a third one as well. And the third one is this: it really does try to demonize Western values. And in particular, it tries to demonize Western values that would generate from the Judeo-Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, what do they have against that? Well, under their particular worldview, they think that any kind of disparity in outcomes is really underpinned by Western values. And so if you can get rid of those values, which are really Judeo-Christian values, then you can have this utopia. So they purposely will speak against and demonize Western values, which are really Judeo-Christian values. So those are, when I'm talking about DEI, I'm talking about making sacred historically marginalized groups, discriminating in order to make sure there are better outcomes for those historically marginalized groups, and finally, really demonizing Western values, which are Judeo-Christian values. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about DEI.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at this in practice, it really doesn't help the people that it is intended to help. And, you know, two recent examples. We had a lady jurist, Ketanji Jackson, who was appointed to the Supreme Court by Joe Biden in the United States last year. But her appointment was based upon his announcement that he was going to appoint a black woman to the court. And even though she was a very accomplished academic and she's a judge in her own right, it sort of put this mark on her that she was being appointed to the court mainly because she was black, which seems to me does a disservice there. On the other side of things, recently we had a black woman who was made the head of the most prestigious university in America, perhaps the Western world, at Harvard. And of course, she was not an accomplished academic. She did not have the history of performance and achievement that one would expect for such a prestigious and important position. And in fact, she was in a way, I felt badly for her because she was set up to fail. She really wasn't ready for that job. And so she was sort of, I found that she was almost sacrificed on the altar of wokeness, of DEI. And so those are two examples, but there's many more where this DEI concept is not only harmful to the people who are excluded through inclusion, but it actually hurts the people that it's intended to help. Would you agree?
Well, yeah, for sure. It does harm those that it's intended to help. We can talk about some other research that Tom Sowell did. He looked at those people who were given privileged spots at elite universities, people of color who were given privileged spots, even with lower test scores. And what he points out is that those particular students were mismatched because they got into this very elite university where everyone else had a test score that was 100 or even 200 points above theirs. And as a result, these very accomplished Black scholars who could have gotten into other universities where the competition with them would have been equal to their test scores, equal to their abilities, and that would have allowed them to thrive. Instead, they get thrown into this very elite university system that is not forgiving, and they fail out.
Yeah.
And so he's saying that often when you think you're going to allow someone to have more opportunity, it just doesn't work out that way because you can ignore reality, but eventually it comes back to the surface. And so that's something that I thought of immediately. But you mentioned Claudine Gay, who was the president of Harvard, and then she was removed. And she did have a terrible research record, incidentally. We saw after subsequent investigation that much of her work was plagiarized,
right?
Which you just aren't supposed to do. But I actually don't feel sorry for her. I think you are right to say that she was a poster child for DEI. But where I would draw that more direct line is that she was not willing to speak out against anti-Semitism. She was brought before Congress. And the situation was, for your viewers, just I'll quickly explain. On Harvard's campus, there were anti-Semitic protests. Now, they were held under the guise that it was about the Israeli conflict with Hamas in Palestine. But really, there were many anti-Semitic tropes being used. There was, it was just true hate speech. And listen, I'm clear that I don't think everything is hate speech. I certainly don't. But there were real examples where they were advocating genocide for the Jewish people on the campus of Harvard. Anyway, Claudine, Professor Gay, the professor at Harvard, was asked, do you think that this is wrong? Now, I'm paraphrasing here. There were numerous questions that were lobbed her way, but essentially she would not speak out against this anti-Semitism. And here's what was happening. You see, she is so immersed in DEI philosophy. She sees Jewish people as a privileged class, as the oppressor. And therefore, anything that's done against them is fair game. I mean, that's the ultimate notion of DEI. It says that if you are in the wrong camp, if you're the oppressor, and the oppressor is typically someone who is performing above the mean. So now Asian Americans are often seen as oppressors. Whites are always seen as oppressors. And Jewish people are now often targeted as oppressors. And under the DEI rubric, it means that you can do whatever you want to them. They're the bad guys. And so Claudine, or Professor Gay, she didn't want to say anything. She didn't want to say that it was out of bounds because she was immersed in this DEI philosophy. And we saw it. And it really, I think that was the thing that got her fired. And then it was, well, that got people interested in her firing. And then the plagiarism sealed the deal.
I would say the proliferation of diversity or of DEI programs has really found its way into all of our major institutions. It's in our schools. It's certainly in the universities. I can tell you without a question, it's in the courts. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But it's also through corporate. And you talk about in your piece that you published in the Western Standard recently, which was a kind of a distillation of the piece that you, the longer piece that you published on the Aristotle Foundation website, which I'd recommend people go and read. You talk about these training programs. You said some very interesting things. You said In one particular damning analysis, some researchers concluded implementation of diversity training has clearly outpaced the available evidence that such programs are effective in achieving their goals. And you say, on the other hand, the research provides clear proof that DEI instruction can activate and even increase bigotry among participants. And of course, you quote people like Ibram X. Kendi, who has said some very salacious things about white people and says them all the time. But talking about this training, this is almost like a Maoist type of indoctrination that's going on in our society. And from your piece, it's clear it's doing a lot of harm. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the fascinating thing, and you've nailed it there, Leighton, is that the claim of DEI is that it makes things better. Mm-hmm. So when people do DEI instruction, when they write their DEI proposals, when DEI is done at business or in academia or government, the claim is always made, it's going to make things better. And by better, what they mean is that it will reduce prejudice. It will make diverse people want to work together more. And that absolutely is not true. The empirical evidence is clear. There is no proof empirically that DEI does anything positive. Conversely, there is really good evidence that it increases prejudice, that it makes people less likely to work together or want to work together. And that was the gist of what I was pointing out in the Western Standard article. But in my larger piece, which is, again, published by the Aristotle Foundation, I go through study after study after study, and I go through meta-analyses as well. Now, a meta-analysis is a gold standard for a study. It takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies, and it puts all of the data together and then statistically looks at the findings of all of the studies and comes to a general conclusion. And the general conclusion related to DEI is that there is no evidence that it does anything positive. Now, you mentioned, you quoted one of the studies that was Devine and Ash. That was their 2022 meta-analysis that said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, being a little bit dramatic. They said, what the heck? Here you are promoting DEI, and it's going everywhere, and it has outpaced the actual evidence. And the evidence, it's easy to outpace it because it's zero. Another meta-analysis, and sorry, I won't go totally wonky on you, but Elizabeth Palak, who was one of the researchers, she's at Princeton. She was at Harvard when she did one of her studies. Then she went over to Princeton, did her other study. It's from 2022, so it's pretty fresh data. Both of her studies, the earlier one and the later one, if you looked at the number of studies involved that were statistically put together in aggregate, it's over 1,000 studies on DEI. And she found that the effect size of DEI training is about zero. Now, for your audience, effect size is the key measure of whether something works or not. If you held DEI training, you would think that the effect size would be would be significant. Right. What it would mean is that someone who went to the training, they came out and they were different. They'd been changed, but the effect size is near zero. And I say near zero, but listen to this, and this is what Palak found, but it becomes zero the more rigorous the study. So the better the methodology, the larger the sample, the bigger the sample size, the closer it got to zero, meaning the more rigorous, the more valid the study, the less likely it was that DEI did anything. And then back to these other studies, there were other single studies that showed DEI training does increase prejudice. So that's a short way to say something that was said in a pretty long fashion in that Aristotle Foundation work I did.
Yeah. And in your introduction to that piece, essentially you have five basic or four basic propositions that you examine. One of them is diversity training in practice, aggressive and justified by circular proofs. You want to talk about that a little bit, about what this diversity training actually is like when you're going through it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I hope your audience hasn't had the displeasure of having to go through
this. I had to go through it once. The Law Society is subjected to us to one round of it.
And we won't
go into that.
Fair enough. And let's keep this in mind. In light of the evidence, in light of what I've just put together for the Aristotle Foundation, which really is the best research evidence debunking DEI, we have to begin questioning why we're doing this training at all.
Right.
And so for anyone in your audience who's watching this and they are about to be forced to go into some of this training, they might want to be armed with that particular research paper because they need to ask the DEI trainer, why are we doing this? What's the evidence you're using? Because it can't be better. It can't be better than multiple meta-analyses. It just can't.
Yeah.
So you said, what's it like to be in the DEI training? If you look into this stuff, it is really horrific, especially for the majority population. So the majority population in Canada is white people. You will be demoralized. You'll be told you are a villain. We have examples from Canada of a young man in medical school out in Manitoba who was attending DEI training when he spoke up and challenged some of the claims related to, I couldn't remember if it was related to, a pro-life position, perhaps, or something. Anyway, because DEI, again, is really hostile toward traditional Christianity, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Well, this guy was expelled. He was a medical student, and he was actually a person of color himself, but he held the wrong attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was expelled. I'm not sure where his court case went. We have a really massive, one of the more public examples when Coca-Cola was doing DEI training for its employees at the executive level. And one of the main ideas was that they had to learn to be less white.
They put that on one of their cans, I think.
Oh, did they? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, so this idea that you have to somehow be embarrassed by your skin color. I mean, we would never, ever say to someone a black person, you need to learn to be less black. Really? Mm-hmm. You're trying to tell me to be ashamed of something that I have no control over? But that was part of the DEI training for Coca-Cola. We have examples of a young guy at Ryerson University, which has now changed its name to something Metropolitan, Toronto Metropolitan University.
Yes.
And they did it, by the way, because of DEI influence. Anyway, this young man, he was in the journalism program, and he was sanctioned because he had written a piece outside of the university, and it was published outside of the university, where he promoted traditional Western values and traditional Christian values. Here's the best example, because you said, well, what's it like in these DEI sessions? And I like to give evidence. So I would commend this to your audience. Look up the story of Richard Biltzko. And he was a principal.
You talk about this in the piece that you published.
I do. Yeah, and in fact, in the Aristotle Foundation piece, I actually linked to it. Mm-hmm. And with Richard's case, he had to do DEI training. And because he was a principal for the Toronto School Board.
Right. Yeah.
So he was forced to do this mandatory training. And in the mandatory training, the DEI consultant who was brought in made the case that Canada was far more racist than the United States. Now, Richard, who had taught both in the U.S. and in Canada, said, well, I got to call you on that. And he was very gentle. And you can hear him because there are recordings. And so if your audience doesn't believe me, go and listen to the recording. So he pushed back a bit on that. Mm-hmm. But just very gently, he said, you know, I've taught both places. I would have to respectfully disagree. And she just went crazy on him. And she started to attack him because of his skin color. And then others started to dehumanize him. You can hear it on the recording where others in the session said, when the whiteness spoke, that was a human being who spoke. And so anyway, the recordings were shared with the WSIB, the Workmen's Compensation, was it? It was some official body that did deem it to be the equivalent of a toxic workplace, and that it was at the level of harassment. Unfortunately, Richard's mental health spiraled after that. He received no support from the Toronto Board of Education. They sided with the consultant on this, ultimately not giving Richard the support he deserved. Anyway, he did commit suicide. But there are other situations that are very similar to this. There was a fella who was at, I believe it was Seneca College or Sheridan College, who had the temerity, I'd say the guts, to actually go public with some of the DEI material that was saying that white people were villains. Mm-hmm. And he went public with it and he was fired for it. Yeah. So not only do they say things that are crazy, if you try to expose it, they'll punish you. Mm-hmm. So that's really the encapsulation of what these sessions are like and what can happen if you try to come up against them. Although we still need to. Yes. I don't want to leave it at be quiet. No. We got into this situation because we didn't speak up, and it's time to now speak up.
Yes, and the fact that their approach to dissent is punitive is very telling. And I want to get your take on this. It seems that the focus of DEI training and compliance is focused on people like, doctors, school principals. Of course, there's the famous case of Jordan Peterson and the psychological college. Lawyers in Alberta were subjected to DEI training under threat of disbarment and suspension if we didn't take the training. So it's very clear that this DEI it almost functions as a religion, which is very intolerant. And perhaps this is why it's so deeply anti-Christian. You cannot offer any public dissent, lest you suffer this type of abuse. I went through a cancel culture experience myself about 4 years ago because I said publicly that I thought that DEI was being used to appoint judges in this country based upon immutable characteristics. And I said something that was anathema, and that is that to appoint people into a position of power and influence like a judge has the power to change people's lives, to send them to jail, to award multi-million-dollar judgments. We in situations like that, we must have our best and brightest people. We can't be selecting people like Claudine Gay and putting them and investing them with that kind of power. And I was roundly canceled. Mr. Farber, Mr. Trudeau's right-hand man, who's part of something called the Anti-Hate Network. That was it. I got kicked off a law society, prestigious law society board that I was serving on. My name was kicked around in the Alberta legislature for 2 weeks. And ultimately, I was forced to resign from a board to which I had been appointed to select judges in Alberta. So they succeeded in getting me off of the board that would have selected, judges based upon meritocratic ability. And so this is really one of the downstream impacts of attacking people like, doctors, lawyers, psychologists, school principals. These are the people who have a lot of influence over things that are going on in society, quote unquote, leaders. And so am I onto something? Is that part of the reason why this training is so focused on people like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you control the cultural elites, you make them afraid. Some of them are going to buy in and then they're bullies, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the bullies will easily manipulate those who are spineless. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we have very few leaders. And especially when it's costly to be leaders, you get even fewer. And you're not wrong. I just want to, it's way, way after the fact, and I'm probably saying something you already know, but when the Trudeau government came in 2016, they implemented a statement of principles, a diversity statement of principles to become a judge. And you had to, and I know you know this, you had to be able to tell a narrative about how you overcame oppression. Yes. I mean, this was part of your application to be a judge. You had to say how you had experienced diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so they were actually using that as a shibboleth or some kind of secret code to make sure they would get the people who would be willing to promote their wokeism in the judiciary. So you're totally right there. One thing I just can't leave this about Bernie Farber and the anti-hate network. I mean, these guys are known to be serial liars. And I'll give you just one example. You may recall from the Freedom Convoy, Bernie Farber put up a post on his social media, which is pretty extensive. And he said that there were signs up at the Freedom Convoy that were promoting Nazism.
Right.
Well, Jonathan Kay, who is the editor at Quillette, did a little bit of investigative journalism and found that the picture of the poster that Farber put up was actually from Florida, that he had tried to say that this was a poster that was up at the Freedom Convoy. And again, it was all to fill in this narrative that, oh, look at the Freedom Convoy. They're a bunch of Nazis. And therefore, look, this poster about Nazis was there. And it was the same poster that had been put on a post in Florida that Farber was trying to put off and say, oh, look, this is what was found at the Freedom Convoy. Complete lie. If he's willing to do that on his public social media, don't think that that's not happening in everything they say.
Right.
So anyway, that was, but again, I can tie this back to DEI, Leighton. They are the purveyors of DEI ideas. And the DEI idea that I see here is any means necessary. Mm-hmm. Any means necessary to rid the world of Judeo-Christian values. Yes. Any means necessary to create equal outcomes. I'm happy to use any lie if it means that I get the ideological advantage. Mm-hmm. And we really do need to open our eyes and know what their end game is. Mm-hmm. Their end game is the destruction of our society as we know it. All the things that contributed to the economic success and the freedom that we enjoy is in peril because these people, these DEI proponents, these progressives, the people who man the anti-hate network, for example, they have an agenda, and that agenda is to destroy what is to replace it with what they see as their utopia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is interesting listening to you. It makes me think of Nietzsche's parable of the tarantula. For those who aren't familiar, there's a parable of the tarantula, and the idea is that the tarantula is an allegorical beast, which basically represents liberals. Small L liberals, but in Canada, I guess large L liberals. And the idea is that this tarantula spins a web and it uses up and it actually devours the very people that it's pretending to help. It comes in the name of equality, or in this case, equity. But what it's doing is it's actually using people, in this case, using victim groups in order to graft power to itself. And it actually devours them, you know, metaphorically. And that seems to be what's happening now. And this tarantula is becoming more and more hungry as we see come into fruition bills like C-367, which would remove the religious exemption in the criminal code to commenting on things like LGBTQ. Or the worse yet now, bill C-63, which is going to permit an organization like the Canadian Human Rights Commission, which is about as left as they come, to actually decide what is and what is not hate speech, and could imprison people like you and me for writing the things that you do and teaching the things that you do, and me for producing a show and talking to you about them. So this seems to be, if anything, coming to a head. And I'm interested to know from you, obviously, using this, this metaphor I referred to, Nietzsche's metaphor, this seems to be the end game, is to graft power. But are we coming to an important sort of head here where we're going to have to, where there won't be any turning back? And what are you seeing based upon you're a sociologist, you see these trends and you've studied this deeply. Do you see signs that perhaps Canadians are starting to reject all of this?
Well, yes and no. And I know that that sounds really equivocal, so I'll explain it in depth. The first thing I want to say is that we people who are awake to what's going on, we people who see the tarantula and we see that they are close to devouring everything, we don't have a lot of time to act on this. Now, some people might take comfort in that they see the conservatives under Polyev are going to be successful. I would be a little bit hesitant to rejoice too early. Our elite politicians, whether they're conservative or liberal, tend to underperform when it comes to our culture when they get in power. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Polyev has been saying a few things that sound promising, but I don't know a conservative leader that hasn't said those same kind of things before they get elected, and then nothing changes. Right. So I'm not hopeful. And the only time it seems that Polyev actually does speak up is after a poll comes out that says he could probably gain a little bit of voter acceptance. He doesn't seem to be guided by principle, but guided by polls. Mm-hmm, that doesn't encourage me. Yeah. I want to be proven wrong. So those who think that government will eventually save them, so the only thing they'll do is vote, I think they're underestimating what needs to happen. I think if we leave it up to government, it might go slower, but the end result will be the same. So what does need to happen? I think people need to realize that it is historically very common that one needs to take a risk and to sacrifice. And it is uncommon not to have to have done that. So I look at the generation of those who were raised in 1910 and then into the 15, 16, 17 into the First World War, and then 1940s, end of 1945, we finished the Second World War. I look further back and I look at those people who fled religious persecution in England, the Puritans. So they're leaving around end of the
1680s or so,
1630s when we get the Mayflower coming. 1632, right. Is that if I knew my rhyme, if I were American, I'd know it better. I don't, but it is not, it was common that one would either fight, so the fight or flee, and we don't have any place to flee anymore. You can't go to the United States, the United States is facing this same problem. So it is time for people to stand up. And I'm not advocating a martial or military response. So that's not where I'm going, because I don't think it's needed at this point. But what is needed is for people to stand up and say, I might lose my job, but I'm going to tell the truth. And unless you are willing to make that sacrifice, unless you're willing to sacrifice your reputation for the truth, unless you're willing to sacrifice your potential employment for the truth, there will be other sacrifices, and it's probably going to be your kids. So you choose to sacrifice now, or you leave it to your children. But one way or another, somebody's got to make the sacrifice.
This reminds me of what Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote about cheap grace. He was talking about, really, cheap grace is another way of saying virtue signaling, right? You know, where you're signaling virtue, you're seeming virtuous, but actually you're not doing anything. And that the real virtue is taking a stand, you know, like Martin Luther, here I stand. And this is something that hopefully is going to become more common. Obviously it needs to happen, but in the meanwhile I'm curious to know, what is it about Christianity which the purveyors of DEI find so offensive? Is it because Christ said that he is the truth, and that therefore set an absolute standard of truth? Or are they actually offended by the idea of love thy neighbor, or you know, pray for your enemies? What is it about Christianity that the DEI cult, if you will, finds so offensive?
I'm sure it's numerous things that they might not even realize. One of the things that the DEI proponents would hate about Christianity is that it makes the divine, it makes Christ the absolute, mm-hmm. and not the state.
Yes.
So they don't like that competition. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Another thing that they wouldn't like about DEI, or I'm sorry, about Christianity, why the DEI proponents wouldn't like Christianity, is that when someone truly believes, they can become fearless. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The whole notion of Christianity is predicated on the idea that at some point you will face your maker, and he's either going to say, well done, good and faithful servant, or depart from me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so for the true believer, that means you don't care about what these earthly powers do. Right. And for earthly powers, that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. That's terrifying, mm-hmm. to think that someone would really be fearless in the face of your lies. But mm-hmm. I don't see that, right? I mean, the advantage that the DEI proponents, the promoters of woke, have is that Christians really do not have the courage of their convictions, are not enough. Yes. In particular, and if I could really point this out, the pastors in particular are incredible cowards.
Yeah.
Try and I have the time. I go through the online sermons of pastors at some of the largest evangelical churches. So these are conservative Protestant churches.
Right.
And yeah. try to find one that speaks specifically about the cultural issues of our day. And you will not. At best, you'll hear them say, you've got to stand up against the culture, they'll say. Now, that to me is fascinating, because mm-hmm. they will not use the words. So what they think is a brave sermon is actually an anti-sermon. Mm-hmm. What they've done in refusing to actually name the problems, radical gender ideology, the mm-hmm. the mutilation of children right now through what I would say is the worst practices related to transgender medicine. And we know that it's really terrible practices, because we have the United Kingdom, Scandinavian countries, other European nations saying, whoa, we're not going to do that anymore, because the evidence says we shouldn't.
Right.
But we have pastors who won't talk about these things, even though it would protect more children, even though it would wake up their congregants to maybe take action. So they won't use the words. They'll say things like, again, you've got to stand up to the culture. But because they won't say what it is, they're actually teaching their congregants, the mm-hmm. people in the pews, something. They're saying, I'm afraid to say the words. You should be too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The message they're actually preaching is, I won't say the words. You better not. Mm-hmm. And so I challenge any pastor, and I actually challenge the people in the congregations. If your pastor is not willing to speak up on these issues at a time such as this, you better find another church, because mm-hmm. you don't have a shepherd, you have a sheep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, we talked about, you talk about the churches, we talked about universities, we talked about government, but it's in our courts too. There's a recent Supreme Court of Canada decision ruled in a sexual assault case that it was problematic for a lower court judge to refer to the alleged victim as a woman, implying that the more appropriate term should have been person with a vagina. And this right. is a judge who was appointed out of Alberta, Justice Sheila Martin, wrote that the trial judge's use of the word woman may have been unfortunate and engendered confusion. And to me, what was significant about this case is that you know, there was no hint of transgenderism in this case. And yet here, you know, the person in the case wasn't identified as transgender, and the complainant is referred to throughout as she. This case is called Regina versus Kruk. So here we have the Supreme Court of Canada now is breaking down our traditional gender binary and is redefining on a legal basis the whole concept of woman, and in a real sense is erasing it. How do we combat this stuff? Do you have any ideas about that?
That is a larger problem for sure. We are now seeing the impact of liberal appointees on our Supreme Court. And we really have seen very ineffective appointees by the conservatives. We have a constitution that is incredibly damaging for true equality. So you and your viewers are probably aware that our Charter of Rights and Freedoms has a section called Section 15B. And right. 15B of our charter says that discrimination, if it's against the majority population and is meant to ameliorate past historical wrongs, well, it's okay. But it doesn't say anything about, well, when has the problem been fixed? Mm-hmm. Does the majority population have any rights in this? The Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario has said the majority population doesn't have any rights. In fact, a few months ago, the Ontario Human Rights Commission said that white people cannot claim discrimination when they are discriminated against for being white. So you've asked, what do we do about a Supreme Court that has now abandoned what would be the principle of fairness? I'm stymied because they're appointed for life, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah,
they're okay, totally unelected and actually operating outside the rule of law in a real sense.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, even we've seen very troubling things from the court in recent decisions. And they always, whenever Christian belief is pitted against the Supreme Court, the Christians lose. Mm-hmm. And the two cases that I look at are the Trinity Western decision. So Trinity right. Western University yeah. wanted to have a law school. It was it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. What had happened was two law societies said, because Trinity Western embraces the traditional Christian notion that marriage should be between a man and a woman, and that should be practiced on their campus, it was deemed that they were too discriminatory to be able to have a law school. And this was the put forward by two law societies. They said, therefore, we should not let these people be lawyers, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is discrimination against a religious group. Went to the yeah. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, actually, you're right. They should not be able to have their own law school because yeah. they have this terrible belief that mm-hmm. Men and women should be married. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. we saw that. And then we saw in the Whatcott decision, so I don't want to go down every legal decision, but people should look this up. Right. So the Whatcott decision was about freedom of expression. And there was a conservative Christian who was saying that homosexuality was a sin. And the Supreme Court said that the problem with Whatcott was the gentleman who was charged, was that he was quoting scripture. And even though that might have been rooted in fact, and even though some of the studies were rooted in fact that he was using, truth was no longer considered a defense. Wow. They said that truth could be used in order to foment hatred, and therefore truth was no longer acceptable. That was the Supreme Court that said that. Mm-hmm. So when truth is no longer a defense for the things you're speaking, when it is clear that the right to religious belief is no longer accepted, as seen in the Trinity Western decision, I wonder if we are so far gone that there's not really anything that can be done. But that doesn't mean we don't do anything.
No, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, cards on the table. I'm a conservative Christian, and therefore I believe that God can pull miracles. I believe mm-hmm. that God can do miracles. And based on that, I say, you never give up. You tell the truth and you let God do the rest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that is great, great advice, a great approach, and a great way to sort of sum up our conversation here today, in which we've learned a lot. This is a part of our show you'll recognize from watching the show, David, where we turn to something called the reading list. So I've got a couple of books that I'm going to recommend, and then I'm going to turn to you and give you the last word. Hopefully you can narrow down, you're obviously very well read. Maybe you can narrow down a couple of suggestions for our viewers and listeners so that, you know, it'll further their understanding of some of the things that you are writing about and that you've talked about today. One of the books, a recent book that I read on this topic is by an American woman named Heather McDonald. And she's written some really great books. She wrote one called The War on Cops, another one called The Diversity Delusion. Those are both touch on the DIE situation. But this latest one is called When Race Trumps Merit, How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives. And she talks about how after the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020, prestigious institutions from the medical profession to the fine arts pleaded guilty to systemic racism. And how else, you know, how could you explain Blacks being overrepresented in prisons and underrepresented in C-suites and faculty lounges, you know, and so this this whole diversity, inclusion, equity ideology or cult, if you like, really gathered steam in the U.S. She explains how and why this happened in much the same way you have today. But she says she also provides an alternative explanation for these racial disparities, and including large academic skill gaps that cause a lack of proportional representation in meritocratic organizations and large differences in criminal offending that account for racially disproportionate prison population, things of that nature. So it's a very fascinating book and an inside look at, you know, the other side of diversity, inclusion, equity, as you've been telling us. And we've talked a lot about on the show about Thomas Sowell. His most recent book is called Social Justice Fallacies. I read this book recently. And of course, he's talking about the concept of social justice, which is sort of another computation or permutation of DEI. And he describes it as the most powerful crusade of our time, with an appeal to many different people for many different reasons. But he says it's not new. And he exposes a lot of social justice fallacies. He reveals how many things that are thought to be true simply cannot stand up to documented facts, which are often the opposite of what is widely believed. And he's just brilliant at this because, of course, everything he writes about, as you do, David, is based upon data. It's not just his off-the-cuff opinions. Everything that he says when he attacks the social justice agenda is backed up by hard economic data and studies like the ones that you talk about in your piece. So I thought that those two would be nice companions to our discussion. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say, what selections you can recommend to us.
Yeah, well, the first book that I'd recommend is called The Wound That Will Not Heal, and it's by Russell Neely. Russell is a political science sociologist, social scientist at Princeton. And this is a phenomenal book. It's actually a little bit older. I think it might be late 80s when he wrote it, early 90s. But I thumbed through it because he really was able to see the writing on the wall. And it's a book about the negative side of affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And he goes through historical data and empirical data and shows time and again that this notion of diversity, equity, inclusion, or wokeism, or social justice, whatever iteration you want to use to describe it, it will lead to the dissolution of society. And so I'm kind of giving away the main part of this book, but he talks about the reciprocity norm. And the reciprocity norm is this notion that I won't let my tribe get ahead. I won't use nepotism. I won't use tribal allegiances to advance my people if you don't. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're going to use more neutral criteria such as competency and merit. Now, that's never perfect because nature makes people different, but it was better than letting people advance because of the tribe. And he says that when this reciprocity norm was embraced, it led to societal flourishing. But when it is rejected, it really leads to societal dissolution. So that would be one of the things that, or one of the books that I would recommend, just because it gives us some even greater data and evidence.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other one, and I know that I think you've talked on your show to Yoram Hazony, who wrote The Virtue of Nationalism, but his recent book was Conservatism, a Rediscovery. So I've been reading that. I keep going back and forth because I keep finding great stuff in it. So Conservatism, a Rediscovery, and it really is. Hazony is a PhD. He's living out of Israel now. He's been on your show, I think, Leighton. And the notion here is, at a time such as this, we need to embrace a grand narrative that can save us. And he suggests that we will return to that which brought us our success. And he says that that is the Judeo-Christian tradition. And so it's time for people to realize we need to conserve the traditions that we had. That's what a conservative is. A conservative is not someone who's this stodgy, old, never change, but they say when something is going wrong, let's look in the past where we got it right and let's conserve that tradition and pass it on. So I really like his thinking and I really like the ideas he's putting forward. It's helping me to clarify what I would say is a really good ideology or grand narrative to replace wokeism.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great book. It reminds me of something that Roger Scruton wrote about in How to Be a Conservative, where he defines conservatism much in the same way as you just said. He said that, you know, I'm a conservative. Well, what is a conservative to? Well, he or she conserves. Well, what do they conserve? They conserve beauty. Well, what is beauty? Beauty are, these are all the things that we find valuable, worth preserving. About our lives, about our past, about our history, about our culture. And so that it sounds like that's really what we all need to be engaged in right now. And that is the way to sort of respond to this attack that's trying to erase everything that's beautiful to us, is to take steps to preserve that. And of course, through your writing and through your advocacy and your teaching, you're doing that. I had the impression from reading your paper that it had the beginnings of a book in it. Is that on the frontier for you? Are you planning to develop some of your ideas into a book?
I am. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. You want to tell us about that?
What I think I want to do is write a book that shows the empirical validity of conservative ideas, and in particular, Christian conservative ideas.
Brilliant.
I hear so often from my academic colleagues about why conservatism and Christian conservatism in particular is a terrible thing and bad for society. And they're just so categorically wrong. Yeah. It's just appalling to me that no one has, well, I'm grateful, I guess, because I'll write the book. I was going to say, I'm, why is there not a book on this? So I think I'm going to fill that gap. What I want to do
the
is
seminal treatise. Yeah. It'd be like Locke's second treatise. Yeah, yeah. It'd be wonderful. Yeah.
Just to comment on that. That would be something that I'd like to do. Can I make one more comment about DEI?
Please do.
I feel like I say a lot of things that I'm against and I want to say what I'm for. So here's what I would say as a concluding statement, if indeed we are at the end. What we were doing before the onslaught of DEI was working. If you look at every sociological measure related to acceptance of others, we were going in the right direction. I'll give you one example. In terms of race, from the 1940s through to the 1960s, from the 1960s in particular into the 2000s, 2010s, all the markers related to acceptance of different races were going in the right direction. If you asked Canadians, do you mind if someone of a different race is living next to you? It kept getting greater acceptance. Of course I don't mind. Of course I don't mind. Do you mind if your son or daughter marries someone of a different race? Of course I don't mind. Those numbers for acceptance kept getting better and better and better without deviation. It just kept getting better. And what were we doing? We were simply saying, don't make race a big deal. Judge people by who they are, how they act, but don't give any mind to these immutable characteristics. That was working. Mm-hmm. And now we've reversed that completely. And now we're beginning to see racism, real racism, from people of color and white people, more discrimination. We're seeing anti-Semitism on the increase again. And it's all because we've legitimized this notion that immutable characteristics are how we should define people rather than who they are based on their internal character. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was happening was working. Let's get back to that.
Yeah, it was wonderfully stated and kind of harkens back to one of the quotations from the beginning of the show from Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, really, the color of your skin is the least important part of you. It's who you are. It's what kind of person you are. What is your heart? Where's your mind? Where are your values? That's the most important part of you. But of course, being race blind now is considered racism by these people, which is truly astonishing. But David, apart from the Aristotle Foundation and their website, if people want to learn more about you and acquaint themselves with your writings, where would they find more of your work?
I think that one of the places that I drop most of my writings when they come out is my Twitter account. It's now X, right? Twitter is now X. And I'm at D. Millard Haskell. So my Twitter call sign is at D. Millard Haskell. And as I write things, I post it there. And my YouTube channel is also linked to my Twitter, so they could find the YouTube channel there. And I think that's probably the easiest way just to keep up to date with the things that I'm writing and putting out.
Well, we'll make sure that those links are provided here so people can access them. And we want to thank you so much for being our special guest today and for providing your wisdom and your insight, and also for doing this important and courageous work that you are doing in pursuit of truth and revealing truth to people, but not just truth, the truth. So I commend you for that. And I'm very grateful that you are doing that, because we need more people like you who are esteemed college professors, university professors, who are part of that intelligentsia, the best minds in our country and in our culture. We need more people telling the truth and revealing it the way you are. And so I'm very, very pleased that we've met you and we've been able to talk to you and to really introduce you to perhaps maybe a broader audience for your writings and your future books. So thanks very much for being our special guest here today.
And we wish you much continued success. I really enjoyed our time together. Thanks a lot, Leighton.
Thanks, David.